Right now, let's check in, as we do each week, with CBS Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent and moderator of Face the Nation, Margaret Brennan. I began by asking Margaret about the new proposed ceasefire agreement that the U.S. is delivering to the U.N. Security Council today.
This is really a full court diplomatic press by the United States on Israel and Hamas to try to come to an agreement that would allow for the release of hostages, the release of Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli detention facilities, and a surge of humanitarian aid that would happen over a 6-week pause in the fighting. That's been the deal on the table. We have the CIA director flying to Doha to speak with Israeli intelligence, the Israeli intelligence chief and other officials. That's happening today in Israel. You have the Secretary of State currently meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, as well as his war cabinet, to push for this deal, as well as some restraint on behalf of Israel in carrying out a more targeted military operation in the south, in an area called Rafah, where over a million Palestinians are jammed in there. And so it would be a high civilian cost should there be a ground assault. You have the Israeli defense minister flying to Washington in the coming days with a list of weapons they want, at a time when in Washington there is a debate over whether Israel can be trusted to use those weapons in accordance with international law and to allow in U.S. aid. That is politically charged. And up in New York today, you have a U.N. resolution with the United States moving forward, supporting a resolution that would endorse a hostage deal and use the word ceasefire, something the U.S. hasn't used to date. So there's really pressure going into this Holy Week, during the Holy Week of Ramadan, Holy Month of Ramadan, I should say, to have at least some short-term pause at a moment when Gaza is on the verge of famine.
You said something interesting. Can Israel be trusted with those weapons? And to me, that plays into this scenario of the U.S. and Israel have always been close, one of the main financial supporters of that country. Mm-hmm. Who is the holdout of this ceasefire and the hostage negotiation? Is it Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, in this, two things there. In terms of the trusting with weapons, that is literally the part of this national security memorandum that the president issued that's being reviewed. And the paperwork handed in by Israel last week, and the State Department has to review whether it's using the weapons the United States has given it in accordance with U.S. law and international law and letting in aid. That is actively under review right now. If they are found to not be, there could be a pause in more military aid to Israel. That would be a significant decision if the Secretary of State went ahead and said, you're not abiding by it. So that's a point of leverage here in these negotiations. What the U.S. is pushing with this hostage deal, there is a lot of pressure on Hamas being exerted through Egypt and through Qatar. They are the countries who are helping to directly negotiate with Hamas, both its political leaders and its fighters. And they have said, multiple Biden administration officials, that what Hamas is demanding is now within range of what could be accepted in terms of the amount of prisoners, for example, they're asking to have released. That had been a holdup. It had been Hamas's holdup for a while. So it sounds like when you have Blinken saying, as he did yesterday from the podium at a press conference, that the gaps are narrowing. It sounds like on that issue, Hamas is coming along. Within Israel, there's a lot of political pressure within the domestic environment on Benjamin Netanyahu to bring hostages home and bring them home alive.
Yeah.
And that's the part of the question here.
Yeah, that was my next question, which is how many hostages do we know where they are and their condition?
The intelligence is not 100% precise here. The U.S. has been helping Israel with the intelligence, but it is Israel in the lead on that. And as we heard just within the past 2 weeks, tragically, one of the dual citizens with the United States, a 19-year-old, was found to have died on October 7th when he was believed to have been held by Hamas. So the intel was murky on that one, and that was Itai Chen. His body is being held, as Israel says, hostage still, but not a living one. In terms of the five remaining U.S. Israeli dual nationals believed to be alive and held by Hamas or other militia groups in Gaza, it's not entirely clear their whereabouts. That is why, even though you hear the emphasis from the Israeli government, from the prime minister, on military force, it is the diplomats who are saying, you got to negotiate this, particularly if you want to bring people home, because in this war, you could unintentionally kill some of these hostages, as we saw happen, or you could just not get to a place where Hamas will give them up while they are still living. So that is why it's the talking, it's the diplomats, it's the negotiating where the focus is right now.
We are hearing from CBS Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent and moderator of Face the Nation, Margaret Brennan. We speak to her every Friday. I wanted to shift our conversation now to the talks being had in Congress this week, where House members were once again up against a deadline to avert a government shutdown. So I asked Margaret for the latest on that deadline.
Here it is again. And if you think these come up quickly, it's because you're right. They just keep coming up with short-term patches and creating new deadlines. So that's why we're constantly coming up to them in these 11th-hour deals, because the broader planning for appropriations and budgeting is not happening during in a regular order fashion. So these patchwork things happen, even though Republican leaders have said they don't want to do them anymore. This is where they end up. In this round, this is specific to a lot of the funding for Homeland Security and other priorities there. You've seen reductions in the already anemic foreign aid package. You've seen, for example, in this package that the House is about to vote on today, reductions in the amount of money that will go to shelters and non-governmental organizations that help migrants, and instead that money going over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement for more beds for people who would eventually be potentially expelled from the United States. So there's a lot of like accounting and moving money around that's happening, but these aren't necessarily big policy changes per se. There are a few things tucked in here, but in terms of whether we'll see a shutdown, that's going to depend on how quickly they move today in the House and whether the Senate is quick to vote. We could see a short-term government shutdown over the weekend.
Everything we've seen since last fall, if you were a betting person, would you say we are going to have another short-term stopgap, or is this it? Is the 22nd the day we fund the government?
Well, I think from what the Speaker of the House is saying, he believes that he can get this voted on this morning in the House and passed. And then some of the senators are already making noise that they may not quickly pass this. So that's why I was leaning into this idea of a short-term shutdown. If you shut down over the weekend, there's less of an immediate impact if you can reopen things on Monday. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's where we end up, but we'll see how quickly Congress acts.
Fair enough. Margaret Brennan, a CBS Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent, and her show, Face the Nation, this Sunday on CBS. Margaret, thank you.
Thank you.
Always enjoy my conversations with Margaret.
If you aren't glued to the TV for the big dance, hoping that your bracket won't bust, there's still lots to do this weekend. Non Sequitur is a Seattle nonprofit that puts on an experimental concert series called Non Sec, and you can check out a show tonight at the Good Shepherd Center. Julie Slick will be playing bass, and as the event page describes, she'll be inviting listeners into her world of space-based exploration. You can get details at nseq.org. There's a comic and arts convention in Port Angeles going on right now. It's called SquatchCon, and it's all about cosplay, comics, video games, and family fun. If you got some old costume pieces laying around or looking for a specific piece of clothing to complete your cosplay, you can check out the swap events going on throughout the weekend. There's also local vendors and food, a perfect way to enjoy some nerdy fun with the family. Tickets are on sale at SquatchConPA.com. One of my first favorite movies growing up was Harold and the Purple Crayon. The story comes to life this weekend as the Pacific Northwest Ballet is bringing the tale to life. The website describes this show as the perfect introduction to ballet for youngsters. Get tickets and more information at pnb.org. Do two things at once this weekend. Enjoy the cherry blossoms at UW and get your workout in. The Legion of Bloom Seattle Cherry Blossom Run is Saturday and Sunday. There's a variety of races to choose from, and once you are done with your run, you can enjoy the Cherry Blossom Festival going on in the U District. There's over 80 businesses in the U District that have special menu items themed around the cherry blossoms in spring. Don't miss your chance at this once-a-year bloom. The Polish Women's Club is putting on the Polish Spring Bazaar this Saturday in Seattle. There will be authentic Polish food, including homemade pastries, as well as arts and crafts. You can get additional details at polishhome.org. On Sunday, you can learn about French culture at Festal, Seattle's French Fest. Enjoy French fashion, cuisine, and wine tasting from a variety of countries, as well as live music. The festival takes place at the Seattle Center. Also on Sunday is Big Climb Seattle 2024, a fitness challenge where people will hike up the 1,311 steps of the Columbia Center to the Skyview Observatory. Teams and individuals raise money for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, which helps fund blood and cancer research as well as support services for patients. Fun fact, the Columbia Center is the tallest building in the Pacific Northwest, at least according to the event page. If you know about cool stuff going on in the region, let me know all about it at pholden@bonneville.com. That's pholden@bonneville.com. I'm Paul Holden, Cairo News Radio.
Seattle's Morning News. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien, along with Tom Hutler and Chris Sullivan. Any parent or caregiver to kids in diapers knows the demand never ends. You're constantly needing them, constantly running out, and they are expensive. So imagine trying to cover that cost in today's world with inflation ruling everything. And that's why the March of Diapers Drive is going on right now. It's an effort founded by Cheryl Hurst. She's the president of the local nonprofit Do the Right Thing and joins us in the studio. Cheryl, tell us about your big goal for the Drive for Diapers this year.
Well, we are going for 500,000 diapers. We actually did 412,019 diapers in 1 month last year. So I guess it could happen.
I think it could. How long does something like 413,000 diapers last you?
Last year we gave to 20 nonprofits. This year we have it down to 17 nonprofits. Unfortunately, it lasts about 3 to 4 months at each one of these nonprofits. They're not giving away a whole box, by the way. They're getting between 12 to maybe 24 diapers a visit. And sometimes that visit's only once a week. And we also collect adult incontinence disposable products because unfortunately neither one of those is covered under a state EBT card, which you can buy food and pop and energy drinks, but you can't buy hygiene products.
I was reading that. It's shocking to me that diapers of all things are not covered by WIC or EBT. Why is that?
First of all, they consider it the same as tobacco and alcohol. It's kind of like something that they feel is not a needed product.
And so we do these diaper drives. Why did you start this a decade ago?
The very short story is try volunteering at a domestic violence shelter, Dawn Domestic Violence Shelter, at Christmas time. And I looked at all the people that were coming through, and they had, you know, they had babies and toddlers and stuff with them. I looked in the storage and there was one box of diapers. So that doesn't really work.
No.
So I asked them why there would only be one box of diapers. And they said, that's not something we really have a budget for.
Here we are 10 years later. You've been doing this since that moment in your life that changed your life. And we're still, the need is what, even more?
Oh, it's craziness. If you talk to a lot of the food banks and any of the nonprofits, people talk about the greater need for food nowadays, of how expensive it is. Very rarely are they getting help with diapers unless they're going to a nonprofit or kindly a lot of churches are now collecting diapers and helping out and things like that. You know, the March of Diapers has been once a year. There are so many food banks everywhere desperate for diapers. I was like, if you have open packages, we take open packages.
Mm-hmm. You think, there's only two left in the package. I'll just toss it. I don't need them anymore. My child's potty trained. You'll take those.
Yeah.
It seems in talking about this, Cheryl, that you just crack your heart wide open when it comes to this drive and connecting community. Why is that?
Well, now you're going to get me all sad. I just can't imagine having no help. You know, I get talking to parents, I've talked to police officers. I talked to a police officer in Kent a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about where he's gone into some hotel rooms where there's things going on with families. And he said, Gerald, I've bought a few boxes of diapers. Just wanted to let you know that. He said, I have an 18-month-old. It's really painful when you walk in there and you see a baby and you can see that that diaper needed to be changed 3 or 4 or 5 hours ago. I just tell people, if you've ever wanted help in your life, go out and help somebody.
You get something back in return.
Yep.
Joy.
Oh, some people, I've never seen people so excited and thrilled to get a box of diapers or to be able to say, you know, you've changed our world. You can't help everybody, but it's like the starfish. You know, everybody's said it a million times. You help that one.
Right. You are the expert on diapers and incontinence supplies. Where can people get the best price and the best value?
Well, it depends specifically what sizes you're kind of working with. What I tell people is it used to be, hey, I always tell everybody, go straight to Costco. And it's like, oh, they're always on sale. Unfortunately, this year, Costco doesn't have them on sale. They still have really great pricing. Mm-hmm. But where the best pricing has come up lately has been Target. Like, hey, right now, this week, spend $75 and get $15 back. You can keep that $15 for your own self. We don't expect you to give it back, you know. So it could be Amazon, have them just ship. We have great little businesses. We have a little place in Black Diamond that sells juice, and they go crazy and give out things to get people to come in. We have big businesses. We have fire departments, police departments. People get it. Who are serving our vulnerable kids or elderly people that get put into a situation that 30 years ago they never expected to be in? Mm. And these are the people that took care of our country, took care of us. Mm-hmm. Did everything that they were supposed to do, but just got put in the situation towards the end of their life. And it's like, why not honor them to be able to help them out also?
And here you are, 500,000 diapers. So if you want to help, you can do the right thing, nonprofit.org. Cheryl, really appreciate your time. Thank you for sharing your heart with us. And I really hope we can help you reach your goal.
Oh, I so appreciate you, Colleen. Thanks so much.
Seattle's Morning News. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien with Dave Ross and Chris Sullivan. Dr. Elizabeth Komen is an oncologist and author of All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. This is very timely as this is Women's History Month, and we deserve to know more about our bodies. So welcome to the show, doctor. Tell me why you wrote this book.
Well, I'm a breast oncologist. I've cared for thousands of women in my career. I've also been a patient, a daughter, a wife, a friend, and in all of my experience have really been exposed and heard heartbreaking stories and experienced women being invalidated for their pain, shamed for their bodies, feeling blamed for their illness, the fact that so many women's diseases take forever to be diagnosed, and we are woefully misunderstood in many ways. And I wanted to change that narrative for the better.
The ways in which this underrepresentation plays out is women apologizing for the ailments that they have or the illnesses or, you know, whatever the symptoms may be. And you were treating a cancer patient, and that's when it dawned on you that something needs to be done about this for women. Do you mind telling that story?
Absolutely. So over my career, I've heard women apologize for countless heartbreaking things that I wish I could say I've never apologized for myself. But the opening of my book is a story of a woman on her deathbed, and she would not be the first or last to apologize to me for something in that setting. In this case, this woman apologized to me for sweating hours before her death. And in a given day, when I see breast cancer patients, both who are sick or well, and I'm doing a breast exam, for example, almost every woman apologizes to me for something: not shaving their armpits, not having a pedicure or manicure, sweating during the appointment, asking too many questions. These are basic, either natural phenomenon or basic needs that we have. And yet, mirroring a lot of what women deal with in society, I think we are afraid of making people uncomfortable, including in a doctor's office. And we disproportionately apologize for things that I don't think we should be apologizing for.
How did this all start?
How did the process start for me, or where do we think it began in the history of medicine?
Well, you'd have to go pretty far back, but why don't we start with, you know, how women were taught not to advocate for their health?
Well, that I think has a long legacy, which is why my book is written both by organ systems and throughout history. But if you go all the way back in time, there's a lot in the medical literature that describes women versus men, with women being the imperfect, inverted, lesser version of men. And you see that carried through at various times in Western medical history. And all the way to today, you know, it wasn't that far long ago. It wasn't until 1993 that women were even required to be part of NIH-funded clinical trials, and minorities as well. So much of the drugs that we use, the devices that we use, the imaging techniques that we have were based on the 70-kilogram reference male and did not include equal participation from women. And that includes not only human subjects, but when we look at drugs or techniques that were developed in the laboratory, it was often male animal models or male-derived cells that much of what we know about medicine was studied upon.
Why do you think that is? Is it purely sexism, or was it just they didn't understand that our bodies are so different?
I think, like anything, it's very complicated. It's an easy answer to say, oh, it's just all misogyny. But we are all a product of our times, and medicine is no different. I think medicine is inextricably linked to culture, society, religion, politics. And as we know throughout history, women have been subjugated and seen as the lesser sex in many different domains. And I do believe that that influenced and infiltrated medical doctrine at various generations and sometimes even to today.
How much of it still persists, though? I mean, I keep hearing that despite the fact that we have actually more women going to college now than men, I'm not sure what it is in the medical profession, you still find women who don't get the health care they need.
Yes, I think if you look at the numbers today, there are many, many, many more women that are in our healthcare system, including going to medical school and becoming physicians. But there are definitely still specialties like orthopedic surgery, electrophysiology for the heart, and other specialties like urology, which remain dominated by men. But it isn't so much a war of the sexes that men can't do what women do, which is, on average, listen longer and spend longer with their patients. We know that women who are operated by women do better than if they are operated on average by men. And again, that's not to say that men cannot have the same nurturing capacity, that can't take the same interest. But it's not just about increasing the numbers of women. It's about really encouraging a culture that values our health, our bodies, and includes listening to women as part of medical discovery.
Well, let me ask you this. Should women basically insist on female doctors?
Definitely not. I mean, part of my writing this book was understanding my own bias as a female physician and some of the Kool-Aid that I had drank about women's bodies and misunderstandings and mistruths about women's bodies. I absolutely don't think that women can't be cared for by men. I think that we just need to change the narrative of how we care for women. And that can happen both for men and women.
Well, what do you do then? You go to the doctor's office, you're having some pain, you don't know what it is. Do you have to listen to your intuition, your gut, or are there some red flags patients can identify that goes, this doctor is not listening to my unique issue?
Sure. Well, no one knows your body better than you. And I absolutely believe that people need to go with their gut and trust their gut if they feel like something is off. That being said, there's a reason why doctors go to school for decades before they can even subspecialize. And that is because we have dedicated our lives to perfecting our craft and gaining the expertise that we need. So it has to be first and foremost a marrying of the patient's understanding about their bodies, what they're concerned about, what they're worried about, and coupling that with a doctor that they trust. If you have a new diagnosis and you're worried about advocacy, I always suggest that patients bring somebody with them, a family member or friend, and a series of questions. Because if you're anxious and you're in pain, I know from my own experience, it is almost impossible to advocate for yourself. We all need somebody there with us. Secondly, it's incredibly important that if you don't like your doctor or feel that they don't like you, it may really be time to move on. This is not a relationship you need to stick out. There are other doctors that could potentially help you. And I always encourage people to get second and third opinions if they feel like they're not in the right relationship.
Dr. Elizabeth Comen, oncologist and author of All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. Thanks so much for joining us. 7:38, your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. Dating can be hard enough as it is, I've heard, and it's made even more difficult when you suffer from a chronic illness. Jacqueline and Alexa Child both live with chronic illnesses, so they launched a dating app geared toward people with disabilities called Dateability. Jacqueline and Alexa joined CBS Mornings to talk about why they created the app.
The world is ableist and people will discriminate against me. People would tell me that I shouldn't have biological children, or they would assume that I would be a burden. And my self-esteem went really down. I felt unlovable. I just didn't feel worthy of love. And then back in 2021, I had to make the decision with my medical team to get a feeding tube, which I still have. And I panicked. I couldn't imagine what dating would be like with a feeding tube. And I just wish there was a safe space for me to find love and meet people with similar experiences. And Alexa,
and you've created that safe space. What's it like for you, Alexa, seeing your sister navigate this and really successfully pulling this off, the two of you together?
It was hard to watch her go through these experiences, especially because she is the most beautiful person inside and out. And so it broke my heart. And I wanted to help her, as her older sister, make this safe space. You know, people with disabilities make up the largest minority in the world. And so the fact that there wasn't anything like this that existed really blew my mind. And so I wanted to be part of the solution.
What a kind thing to do. The app again is called Dateability. You know what that music means. At 7:48, G. Scott joining us from the G. and Ursula Show. And you have been watching the March Madness games.
No doubt about it. And you know, I've been watching them Cougs. Go Cougs. Shout out to the Cougs out there. If you are an alumni of that place or you support that place, I am so happy for you. Here's what I want to bring you guys into something. So, as you all know, the G and Ursa Show comes on every single day at 9 a.m. Well, while you all are working here, we're out here preparing the show. So this morning, I sat back and I just waited. And I wanted to see Dave and Colleen and Sully. I wanted to see if anything would be mentioned about the Cougs. So I said to myself, self, sit back and wait. And so Chef and Ursula, we're all getting a rundown and we're talking about all these things. And we're going to be talking about what's going on in Everett and Boeing and all this stuff, right? So at the very end, I said, you know what is interesting? So because UW was not in the tournament, because they don't even have a head coach, and they don't even have an athletic director, the fact that the Cougs are in the tournament and they win with a local kid of Isaiah Watts, the son of Donald Watts, the grandson of Slick Watts, for some reason, that didn't make it in our rundown.
I didn't know
so
that.
It brings me to the next point. There's Husky bias in this state. It's always this Husky bias where it's like they're the big bros and they're the big family member and stuff like that. But they walk around like they a 10, but they really a 6.
Now, can I offer a counterpoint, which is is this less of a Husky bias and more of a football bias?
Well, I have a different take even on that, but respond to that one.
You know what, Dave?
Because what if the Cougs made it into the college football playoffs? I think we would all be freaking out about that, right?
Sure. Now, but I'll say this. You see, my co-host Ursula, she follows the Huskies a lot, right? So, in all fairness, but anytime the Cougs are doing something, I thought that we're supposed to be unbiased. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to show love, right? Right? But, you know, I just want to give love to the Cougs.
Now, my take.
What's your take, Kylie?
Is that March Madness has always been about Gonzaga. Ah. That's why we're not paying attention to the Cougs.
Oh, what did Gonzaga do?
I don't know,
they won in a game that they were supposed to win, I think.
Yeah, but they always make it to like the Final Four and the Elite Eight. They're always the one to go the distance. Everybody's focus is usually on Gonzaga.
I thought their focus was on like Gonzaga makes it every time and never wins it. I'm just trying to figure it out.
Gonzaga's better than the Cougs. I'm just saying the reason why you're not hearing about the Cougs is because we're so used to focusing on. They've been a dominant team in this tournament. for years and years and years.
It's like making fun of the two ladies that always go to weddings all the time and both of them ain't never been married. You know what I'm saying? You ain't got a ring either, Lois.
So, Sully, do you have a counterpoint now that we're all having good sports points?
No, my team isn't in it, so I'm not paying attention.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. Well,
but my ladies are, and they're playing later today.
Oh,
so.
Who's that? Who are your
Notre
ladies?
Notre Dame.
Notre Dame.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're two seed.
Notre Dame ladies. Yeah. That's good to hear. Yeah. So who do you, where, how far are the Cougs going and will they go further than Gonzaga?
I don't know that. Oh. And I think that's the beauty in college basketball right now. I will tell you this, Colleen. There is a new March Madness now. There was pre-NIL, name, image, likeness, March Madness. And there's today's March Madness, where before you had a bunch of kids getting there, hungry, doing their things. Now you got some of these young kids getting sometimes $1 million, $750,000 when they're coming in. And when you're 18 years old and you're getting $750,000, $1 million,
I don't know
about you. If y'all remember when you were 18, just imagine. Well, the reason why I bring that up is because last night we had Oakland, a very small school in Michigan, beat Kentucky. Think about that for a second.
I love it.
Kentucky gets beat. Why? Because we're in a new era right now. Mm. So to answer the question, I don't know who's going to go further, but I do know that there will be more upsets because you got a lot of grown men in college basketball. And even though they aren't popular, they've been playing for 3 to 4 years. They're going to beat the young kid with a bunch of money. Gotcha.
Thank you, G. Always a fun time.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs. It is 8:14 on Seattle's Morning News. As we mentioned at the top of the hour, it is the 10-year mark of the deadly Oso landslide. And our reporter, Cairo News Radio's Kate Stone, got a look at how things are going up in Oso today.
Saturday, March 22nd, 2014, 10:37 a.m.
Then hundreds of trees have fallen outside of my house.
The tiny Washington town of Oso wiped off the map in seconds.
Are there any injuries?
Yes, there's people yelling for help.
10 years later, the scars of the disaster are still visible on that hillside and present within the hearts of those left behind.
And I had to tell my mom I couldn't find her. And she started crying and she said, Dane, you just need to find your sister. Go find your sister.
Dane Brunner's sister Summer and 42 others lost without warning. The roaring, deadly wave of mud and trees smashed into homes at the speed of a car on the freeway. Tim Ward heard Brandy, his wife of 37 years, shout his name.
My wife and I had reached out towards each other, and within a matter of a second, that part of the house disappeared.
In the hours that followed, frantic search efforts rescued a dozen from the quicksand-like mud.
The first day, we dug with our hands, literally.
It remains the deadliest landslide in U.S. history. The scope of the tragedy was felt across the country. President Obama visiting the collapsed hillside and meeting with survivors, victims' families, and first responders coping with unimaginable loss.
We're not going anywhere. We'll be here as long as it takes.
Every year, on this day, the community comes to a spot along SR 530 in the shadow of the slide's deadly path to pray and read aloud the names of the 43 victims with a moment of silence at 10:37 a.m.
I want people to come here and see hope. I want them to see that what transpires when a community comes together.
This year is different. This year, a decade-long promise is fulfilled as a permanent memorial is finally unveiled. For Jessica Pizanka, who lost 6 members of her family, it's a way to honor the victims, the first responders, and the survivors oh so strong 10 years later.
It was very important to us that this area didn't feel like a giant cemetery or tombstone. We wanted it to be beautiful.
The ravaged hillside is clearly visible in the backdrop of this two-acre site.
You would come here and sit and look at the differences and see how the community was formed.
As you walk through a wooden archway at the entrance, bearing a date and time that so many lives in Oso changed forever, you can see a paved courtyard and pathway.
It's paved for only a mile, which represents where the slide started and ended.
The beginning of a journey through the community's history.
The memorial site itself has four main items. You come in and it talks about the geological event itself, the first responders, the community, and the community response, the survivors and the victims.
Each touch, each design choice is not by accident.
There is a beacon in the front or in the middle of the area. And when the sun hits it on the 22nd at 10:37, it shines the light directly on a rock, a big jade boulder.
The same boulder that was found in the debris when the hillside came down. As you walk, colored rocks along the paved path mimic the curves of the Stillaguamish River.
The Serenity Trail was my biggest part because that was where I got to be a little bit selfish and say, this is where my sister gets to live on.
And at the end of the path, 43 curved wrought iron panels, each custom designed and decorated by the victims' families to represent the life lost. Some with illustrations etched into the metal.
This is actually her horse, and his name's Gabby, and she went out in the field and knelt down like that, and then Gabby just comes over and then kisses her.
Other panels have photos or quotes.
Like with my wife, where she had a love for hummingbirds, and she loved her flowers. She had plants everywhere.
Finding the millions of dollars needed for this project took years, but the community never gave up.
My parents were very discouraged. They were kind of part of the committee with me very early on, and they're like, at this rate, this thing is not going to be built in our lifetime. And I was like, you are wrong. I will make it work.
Cairo News Radio was one of many to help raise money, collecting tens of thousands of dollars to see this emblem of loss and hope become a reality. A chance to say goodbye to loved ones in a way they never got to that day.
It was one of those events to where you don't have that one last chance to say I love you. I didn't get a chance to say that to my wife. I just got to be able to look at her eyes.
And a source of healing for those still rebuilding their lives.
She wouldn't have liked any of this at all because it glorifies her life. But that's okay. She can be mad at me. I miss her a lot.
Kate Stone, Cairo News Radio.
10 years since that landslide. Whew, Kate, that's got us all crying today. Sully, you were out there. Tell us what you remember.
Gosh, some things just burned into my memory because we were out there and we didn't get access to 5:30 for like a day or two because, you know, they had to mobilize so many people to get out there for the search. You know, as we heard, they were digging by hand at first, and it was just people coming from wherever, from Darrington, from here, from Arlington. They were going out with shovels, and they were just the whole little community. And then eventually they had to like kick out some of the locals, and they were like, listen, we're doing a grid thing here, and we're bringing in the professionals. Here's the National Guard.
The locals wouldn't give
here
up.
All the, no, they wouldn't. They just kept digging and digging. And I remember the first thing I remember when I got there, when they took us in about, I think it was probably 2 days after, maybe less. And the first thing you see is just an army of people in hazmat gear, all just top to bottom covered in mud and, you know, just a look on their face of dazed look of just unimaginable tragedy and awe in the scope of this. And then as you took a few more steps, there was this tattered American flag. It had been in, you know, hanging in one of the houses, and they'd found it early on.
Right.
And, you know, they hung it right there where all that workers would, as they went into the debris pile right there on fight, was right there.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually they hung it up, you know, on a post next to the tree where we saw the Oh So Strong stuff pop up, and, you know, it was ripped and tattered and muddy, and but it represented, I think, the resolve of the people. And then you know, a couple other things. They had to dig a temporary road on the hillside to get heavy machinery in there because they just couldn't get through the wall of debris and mud and trees. It was huge. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as they're working in there, I remember we sat up there for several hours just watching them dig and the slide was off to the north of us. And, you know, for the first time, everything went quiet. Just deathly quiet. I mean, you could barely hear the birds. And I was like, hey, you know what's happening there? Like, hey, whenever we found human remains or think we have, we shut it down so we can take that person out of the mud and take them to where they need to be. And you knew right away that the next time that happened, it was like, oh, they've. And then the last thing was I remember going up and talking to one of the survivors at Harborview, Amanda and Baby Duke. Yes. Amanda and Baby Duke was a newborn. Yeah. And the house just gets smashed with this wall of water and mud and debris. And she just protected
him.
This bear hug that only a mom could probably do in this kind of over a newborn that she thought she was going to be crushing to death. Mm-hmm. But she would not let go of that baby as they were driven through the mud and debris. And basically on half a couch that kind of protected them. Mm. And, you know, she was, I mean, that I just will never forget the strength that she showed in such an unbelievable time of just disaster. Yeah. And, you know, so those are the kinds of things I'll take. When I'm going to get up there this weekend, I think, just because it's a beautiful sight. And, you know, it's coming back to life now in terms of, you know, Mother Nature's returning and things. But yeah, if you get a chance, once this weekend kind of passes, I mean, this is for the families in that community, I think, right now, maybe tomorrow, the next day, but get a chance to get up there. One, it's beautiful. It's serene, and I'm excited kind of to see it, what it looks like in its final spot.
I'm so happy everybody could come together and provide the funding for this memorial. It's important for these families to have a site to grieve, and, you know, clearly for the community to grieve and those who were impacted by this. So, yeah, thank you for your reflections and your reporting, Sully. It is 8:47. That's Mickey time. And this is a Mickey and Chris mashup because, Chris, you actually found this article.
Yeah, when I saw the headline got me and I'm like, whoa, this is right in Mickey's wheelhouse right there.
Oh, my God.
So for our Ozempic reporter.
Yes,
right?
You started Manjaro the Ozempic Mounjaro conversation.
Yeah.
And the headlines just keep coming, especially now with Oprah on board with this. But the latest one is not a development I would be thrilled about if I was on Ozempic.
Well, here's the thing that a lot of women and some men, but mostly women who get on these medications and aren't taking it for type 2 diabetes are taking it for the precursor to type 2 diabetes, which is insulin resistance, which can cause infertility. Mm. I know that I was someone who was diagnosed with insulin resistance, and along with that, and I'm not a physician by any means, but I've done my homework and I'm also someone who's been treated for this, also came infertility. And so it became very hard for me to get pregnant, which is why it was so nice that when my wife tried and she got pregnant on the first try every time, I was like, well, pressure's off me.
Yes, if you're somebody who still wants children and you're dealing with a weight loss journey, mm-hmm. I suppose this would be a great development. So let's take the lid off the big news.
Exactly. And what is so exciting is that we are seeing this trend now on social media, and even the story on the website that Chris found is that a lot of these women who've reached their weight loss goals are now getting pregnant, and they're sharing their stories on TikTok where they otherwise couldn't get pregnant before because of the insulin resistance. And these GLP-1 medications that they're taking are actually kind of, I guess, a very simplistic way is reversing the insulin resistance and allowing their bodies to do what it's supposed to do, which is get pregnant.
Have babies. If you want to. That is incredible. And so, based on what you're seeing online, mm-hmm. are these surprise pregnancies? Because I don't feel like the researchers knew this was coming.
No, I don't think so. And you know what? For me, as someone who is married to a woman and how we had to have our kids, I can't imagine that anyone is like, surprise, I'm pregnant, because you know how to have a baby, right?
But you've been infertile for years, and then you're losing weight and you're just focused on weight loss, but you still have relations.
And the article also mentioned that it could also, the drug has a way to potentially hurt the efficacy of birth control.
Right. Yes,
so these people
can.
Are
yes.
on birth control yep. as well and getting pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So there's a little bit of that that was very interesting hormonally.
Right.
I was like,
right.
wow.
And yes, so you're both right in that someone who's been told, listen, you're not going to be able to have kids, you're infertile, you've got PCOS, this is an issue, start taking this injection, and then boom. Now, a lot of these ladies are coming on TikTok and Instagram reels and all of this and saying,
yeah.
I'm having a baby. And I was told that I could never have a baby before. Now, I'm not saying go take this medication and you'll get pregnant. But
right.
this just seems to be another side effect.
It makes sense, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of hormonal issues can be tied to weight gain. It can
yeah,
be
obesity.
Tied to stress.
Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. and so if you are then losing that weight, it mm-hmm. would make sense that your body is in a state now where it can produce the hormones needed to become pregnant.
Right.
So that makes sense, although
yeah.
it seems like it was unexpected.
Absolutely. A lot of the times they are.
Yeah.
Yep. It's unexpected. I mean, these peptides are really changing the course of a lot of people's lives. I mean, even Ozempic, as of last week, came out with another study that it lowers the risk of cardiovascular events like stroke, heart attack, and death in adults who have known heart disease. And so that's another ding, ding, ding for, you know, those medications, those GLP-1 medications. And Medicare just announced that it's going to start covering Wegovy for weight loss.
Wow. The power of Oprah, right?
That's what I know.
Okay, so I think it's fair to mm-hmm. also drop us down to reality. This is really good news for a lot of people. The weight loss, the mm-hmm. pregnancies, the, you know, everything else that comes along with it. The success story is yourself being one of them, mm-hmm. Mickey, but you will be the first to talk about also how difficult it can be to start these medications.
Yes.
And it can lead to serious complications.
Absolutely, it can. These medications are not something that you're just going to take and you're going to be fine and great. That's why when you take an injection like this, like a GLP-1, you have to be closely monitored. So for you to say, oh, I'm just going to take a shot and life is going to be glorious. No, there are a lot of complications that can arise. I lost my gallbladder. I had a lot of issues with pancreatitis. I was nauseous a lot. I experienced, oh, I got to go to the bathroom. Like, this medication is not for the faint of heart. Eventually, a lot of these symptoms do go away, but I am still closely monitored. My doctor calls me in every 6 weeks. We have to do labs. We have to check my kidney functions. We have to check my liver enzymes. We want to make sure that I am okay and that I still have the all clear to continue these medications.
That's the responsible way to go with this.
Absolutely.
So
you can't just go to one of those, one of those compounding clinics and say, oh, give me the shot. No, you really need to be monitored closely by your physician if you're going to be on a GLP-1 medication.
Well, this is a positive development, I'd say. If you want to become fertile again and, you know, have a child one day, this
especially,
is exciting
yeah,
for women.
Especially if you've been told you have PCOS or you suffer from insulin resistance,
yes.
which is the precursor to type 2 diabetes.
Yeah. Thank you, Mickey.
You're welcome.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show. We'll be right back.